Oh, because Chris is here.
We good?
All right, we will begin the open session portion. It is about 6:12 right now. I'm going to report out from our closed session. During closed session, we had discussion about student personnel students and a stipulated expulsion for two students. We had a conference considering our labor negotiations. We also had a review of possible action on employment and dismissal or discipline of district employees. So is there a consensus now on the order of business?
May I make a motion?
Yes.
Suggestion?
Mrs. Sheffer.
I would suggest that in the interest of people who have come tonight to discuss item 9.09, the Johnson Street Project EIR, that perhaps we move that up to 9.01 if my fellow trustees are in agreement.
Are we all in agreement on that? Okay, so we will move that item to 9.01 from 9.09. Okay, we also have received correspondence to the board. I see here at least six, and I think we are now almost at a dozen letters and emails regarding the Johnson Avenue project, and we've received that correspondence, and I know that I've read most as of this afternoon. So, yes. Oh, what did I just do? I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, that's right. We jumped to correspondence, and we need to deal with the action on closed session, 4.02. Okay, so we need action on the two stipulated student discipline. Let's start with student A.
I'll move approval of the stipulated expulsion for student A.
And I'll second.
Okay, Mr. Millar makes a motion to approve the stipulated expulsion and seconded by Mrs. Roger. Is there any discussion? Okay, do we need a roll call vote on that or just simply, okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. With one absence, that was Mr. Unger, is not present. As far as the student stipulated expulsion on student B, do we have a motion on that?
I'll move to accept the recommendation on student B.
And that was Mrs. Sheffer, seconded by Dr. Eisendorf Rogers. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And Mr. Unger is absent. Okay, now with regard to item 4.05, the approval of the minutes. No, we still have one more, right? I'm looking probably at the... Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. I got it. All right. The board is also reporting out on action taken in closed session. The board approved the superintendent's recommendation to dismiss a permanent classified employee, number 52936, a custodian one, by the following roll call vote. Mr. Buckman, Dr. Eisendorf Rogers, Mr. Millar, Mr. Questenberry, Mrs. Rogers, and Mrs. Sheffer voted yes on the dismissal, and Mr. Unger was absent.
And who made the motion and second, please?
Okay, so the motion was made by Mrs. Sheffer and seconded by Mr. Millar. All right. All right, now we'll move to item 4.05, the approval of minutes. Mr. Buckman moves approval. Second by Mr. Millar. Any corrections? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes have been approved. Now for some of us, our most enjoyable part of the meeting, report by student representatives. Shall we begin with Scott?
Good evening. My name is Scott Hicks, representing SLOHI. In ASB news, we had winter formal over the weekend, and in my 4 years at SLOHI, I think it was the most successful winter formal in terms of fun and just a good atmosphere. It was called the Mardi Gras Masquerade, so the masks added a really cool environment. And then now we're turning to Spring Fling, which is going to be on the Ides of March. In the administration, we had Career Day last week for juniors, and we had over 70 different occupations from the workforce coming to our school, and the juniors went around to all of them. And there's also some guest speakers to open their eyes at what they might possibly want to do after high school and perhaps after college. And then last week, we also had Skills USA, which we're very talented at. In Salinas, it was the regional competition, and we only have results from Otto so far, but we won first, second, and fourth. And the first and second, which were Kelly Ziegler and Kevin Houston, are guaranteed to go to state. And fourth place, Anna Mullen, is maybe going to state. And that's for Otto. We're still awaiting results for the other categories. In athletics, both of our soccer teams are having great seasons. Boys are one game behind, I think, AG and Rigetti for league first. And the girls are in first. We are beginning interviews for our new head football coach for next year because, as you know, our last football coach retired. And spring sports have begun practicing due to different CIF rules this year, so we can practice earlier. And that's it. Thank you for having me, and I'll pass on the mic.
Hello, my name is Kalen Richardson. I graduated from Pacific Beach last week after a great career at the school. I'm extremely thankful for Pacific Beach for a variety of reasons. I'm happy to be here today. Prior to attending Pacific Beach, I had two injuries that impacted my learning ability. Once I transferred to Pacific Beach, I found a culture and teachers that actually cared a lot about how they work with each student. Finally, to earn my high school diploma. Because my hard work and the teachers at Pacific Beach, not only do I have my diploma, but now I will be starting Lors College February 10th, which is next week. And I'm looking forward to taking the next step in my life and starting my college career. We wrapped up the third marking period a couple weeks ago. Mr. Aranguena and Mr. Marano are eagerly crunching data to identify student achievement. Mr. Aranguena now teaches an orientation class for new students, and our students' intake process is much more involved than in the past. Because of this change to the program, the data shows that new students are finding success at a much quicker rate and adapting to the program with a higher success rate. We now have a grant-funded math class where students are learning geometry concepts while building real skateboards, which brought these two today. That class is taught by our math teacher, Ms. Wilder, and a community member, Mr. D. Furman. I don't know if I got that name right. Ms. Jacobson is co-teaching two classes, one with a guest artist, and the other is a health class with an educator from CAPSLO. Ms. Newman is getting each student at Pacific Beach online with our new reading program, Achieve 3000. It allows us to get Alexa reading scores for every student and to make sure that every assignment in English, science, and history is at the right reading level for the individual student. Mr. Aranguena now has his U.S. and world history lessons online so that students can access them anytime on his WordPress website. Pacific Beach is in the process of purchasing 20 student laptops and teacher iPads and will be shortly have Wi-Fi in all the classrooms for web access, Apple TV. We have three volunteer tutors working with our students now, and Cal Poly students working with some students for her senior project called Changing Layers. Lastly, I have been in charge of running the barbecue for back-to-school nights and open house for the last 2 years. I will be back in April for our open house to barbecue one last time for this year. we'd love for you to drop by.
Thank you, Kaylin. Now, are you going to drop by at another board meeting, perhaps? Can we?
Maybe. Maybe.
Well, congratulations on your graduation. We're very proud and happy that you've done that.
Just have a comment for Mr. Hicks. Mr. Hicks, I heard your poetry out loud recitation. You rocked those poems. That was great. Good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And who is representing Slow High at Poetry Out Loud tomorrow?
Chrissy Miller. I should bring that up. I think that's this Thursday, actually.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Right, yeah. This is tomorrow?
No.
Thursday, yeah. Sorry.
Chrissy Miller, she's incredible. I think she's going to win. I think she is.
She's a real love of poetry, that young lady. Yeah,
yeah, she's really
awesome.
Good.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Scott, where will that be?
It's going to be in here.
Right here.
I don't know the times. I should have gotten that, but I would. It's 7 to 9.
Seven to nine in here.
Thursday. It's going to be fun.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much. You're welcome to stay for the rest of the board meeting, but if you have important things to do, like classwork or getting ready for college, feel free to leave. So thank you very much. We are now on to the public comment portion. Wait a minute, we have one more thing. Second student achievement report. I'm just jumping ahead of things all over the place. So Mrs. Shields, are you leading the way?
Good evening, Board. I'd like to begin by introducing our team that developed the Second Student Achievement Report. Along with co-director Kim McGrath and myself, we have Darla Batistic and Aaron Luntz, our assessment teachers on special assignment, as well as Jen O'Hagan, our ed tech, and ELD TOSA, who produced our pictures and video tonight. And with that, we will begin. Tonight, we're going to present the Second Student Achievement Report by focusing through the lens of how our efforts contribute to college and career readiness of San Luis Coastal Unified School District students. In your packet, we shared a preschool through post-secondary continuum of academic readiness that was developed by the Achieve organization. It listed indicators that will improve students' overall college and career readiness. Those indicators begin as early as preschool. In San Luis Coastal, we also are identifying similar indicators to determine college and career readiness for our students. Some of our assessment and data indicators listed are well established and some are under development, like our common assessments aligned to Common Core state standards. We will begin tonight by sharing what the assessment of our very youngest children is indicating and move across the grade levels all the way to what our post-graduation data is telling us about our students' college and career readiness. We will conclude our presentation with a quick tour into our classrooms to highlight some of the changing expectations and practices happening with teachers, principals, and most importantly, with our students to ensure their college and career readiness. Darla?
All right. We'll start with some elementary data. One indicator of early reading success is the Benchmark Assessment System, or BAS, reading level. The BAS is a one-on-one reading assessment given to all K-2 students. Results for students in kindergarten through second grade indicate that more than 80% of our students are on track to meet end-of-year proficiency in reading. This is the first year kindergarten students were assessed in the fall with the BAS. And while we didn't identify any kindergarten pre-emergent readers as at risk on this assessment, sites use other indicators to identify kinder students in need of early intervention. We noticed that 29% of first grade students and 24% of second grade students are at risk in reading and require intensive intervention, such as reading recovery and leveled literacy intervention, in tandem with differentiated classroom instruction in order to meet year-end proficiency. Let's take a closer look at the BAS. We've been following this data for our first and second grade students for 3 years now. This is a three-year comparison for just the first and second grade students. We identified a decrease this year in the number of students identified at risk in the fall. 26% of our first and second grade students were at risk in the fall, and that's more than a 5% decrease over the previous 2 years. A number of factors may contribute to this decrease. We know our preschool and transitional kindergarten programs are positively influencing kindergarten readiness. Instructional practices in kindergarten are shifting to meet the rigor of the Common Core expectations. And strong research-based interventions that are aligned to our instructional model are in place for all K-2 students at each of our elementary sites. Each of these factors contribute to the reduction in the percentage of students at risk in the fall. For students in grades 3 through 6, the Scholastic Reading Inventory is administered to determine a student's lexile reading level, one indicator of reading success in upper grades. Our fall results indicate that 83% of our 3rd through 6th grade students are on track to meet year-end expectations, and more than half have already met or exceeded year-end lexile proficiency. The percentage of students who fall into the at-risk category decreases as you go from 3rd grade to 6th grade. However, 14 to 22% of our 3rd through 6th grade students still require reading intervention that's focused on deep comprehension of grade level text. Students in kindergarten through 6th grade are currently completing their mid-year assessments in reading to guide instruction and plan for intervention. As part of our implementation of the writing units of instruction that you've been hearing about, students in kindergarten through 6th grade will be assessed with 3 end-of-unit on-demand writing tasks. This graph shows the results from the fall assessment in narrative writing. More than 75% of the students scored basic, proficient, or advanced on this fall assessment, indicating that they're on track to meet end-of-year proficiency in writing. The data also indicates that while our students in grades K-3 are able to demonstrate grade-level writing skills aligned to the Common Core expectations, our 4th through 6th grade students struggle to do so. And we know that it will take a few years of daily writing workshop instruction to strengthen upper grade elementary writing performance. However, teachers at every grade level are noticing a positive shift in student writing since implementing the units of writing. In June, we'll share some early indicators of elementary math performance when our common assessment cycle is complete. But tonight, I would like to share results from our math attitude survey. For the past 3 years, we've asked 2nd through 8th grade students to respond to the same set of positive statements about mathematics. We know that a student's attitude, skills, and strategies are intertwined and directly related to their performance in mathematics. As math instruction shifts in our district, we wanted a way to measure growth over time in the general attitudes and dispositions of our students. The gold line represents student responses from 2 years ago. The green represents last year's data, and the blue represents this year's results. We've identified 3 areas of a shift in student responses. The first is about the usefulness of math as asked in question 1, people use math in their jobs, and question 8, math is useful in solving everyday problems. Students more strongly agree with both of these statements. The second area I'd like to point out are questions 3 and 11. They ask students about solving problems. Number 3, there are many ways to solve the same math problem. And number 11, I know many ways to solve the same math problem. Both show a shift in the way students view problem solving. This seems directly related to the way teachers are teaching mathematical problem-solving practices using mathematical tasks. And finally, I'd like to point out the growth in positive responses to number 13. Working with other students can help me understand math. It's exciting to see our students embracing the 21st century learning skill of collaborative work. At this point, I'd like to turn over to Erin, and she'll share some secondary college and career readiness data with you.
The term Lexile has come up at least twice this evening. Could you give us just a brief explanation of what that means? What's that mean?
Sure. I think that term, I'm kind of glad you asked, because I think that term is going to come into play quite a bit as the Common Core is implemented. There is a Common Core standard that addresses text complexity, and Lexile is one way to measure a text complexity level for a student. So the SRI is a reading passage test where students, from what they've read, have to pick a vocabulary word that helps them give the overall gist of what they've read. And that determines their Lexile level. It's computer adaptive, so they'll get harder and easier questions until it sort of settles in on the level that they've completed.
So it's safe to say it's really an indication of the sophistication of their vocabulary?
Yes, definitely. And also of somewhat of their reading comprehension. It is not meant to be a diagnostic tool that gives you a full explanation of that student's reading ability. That would be better done with the BAS, which is a diagnostic tool. But the Scholastic Reading Inventory is a great universal screener. So it gives a very first pass, very high level. Where are students? Where do we need to focus attention?
Right. Starting in 2011-12, we administered Common Core aligned assessments in English Language Arts to students in grades 7 through 12. The fall assessments include both a multiple choice and a paragraph writing task. Over the past 3 years, we've seen growth in our multiple choice results. This year, we set a new baseline for the paragraph writing task by utilizing the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, or SBAC, rubric, which is more aligned to college and career-ready expectations. We found that 60% of our students were proficient. While most of our students are meeting expectations on these assessments, our next step will be to continue to develop skills for Common Core level writing and performance tasks. In math, we also started administering our performance tasks in 2011-12. The first year, we scored a sample of students, and only 13% were proficient in making sense of the task. Last year, we administered the same tasks, and about one-third of our students were proficient. This year, performance tasks were selected from the Silicon Valley Mathematics Initiative, or SVMI, to assess all students in pre-algebra through algebra 2. Both the tasks and the expectation of the rubric are more aligned to what SBAC assessments will look like and college and career-ready expectations. They ask students not only to make sense of one task, but also to attend to precision and construct sound mathematical arguments on multiple tasks. With these new, more rigorous measures, we found that only 22% of our students were proficient. These results show us that our secondary mathematics students will need more support and experience with these kinds of conceptually challenging problems. The cohort graduation rate differs from traditional graduation rates because it includes all students that are in ninth grade at a school or district, and then tracks them and calculates the graduation rate based on where they are in 12th grade, regardless of where they're enrolled. So we have seen that we still have a very high rate, 96%, and above the county and state. In order to gain admission to Universities of California, UCs, or California State Universities, CSUs, students must complete a series of pre-approved courses, also known as A through G requirements. Slightly over half of SLCUSD students complete these requirements upon graduation, well above that of the state and the county. 2012 was our first year we had district-wide data for our AVID students, who far exceed the district rate. Our goal for AVID students is 100%, so that they can meet these requirements and gain access to four-year colleges and universities. The early assessment program includes an English language arts test and a math test. And this assessment allows students to bypass placement tests and remedial courses at many California colleges and universities. With successful completion of coursework, 48% of our 12th graders are ready for CSU level courses in ELA, that's the two green bands together, and 36% are ready in math. We offer a wide variety of advanced placement courses. We continue to add more courses. We saw a jump in enrollment in 2012-13. And of students in those courses, 68% take the AP exam, and 79% pass that with a grade of 3 or higher. So that could give them credit, college level credit. All right, and here's this next one. The next three slides are from the National Student Clearinghouse data. We're members, and their database includes 96% of post-secondary institutions. This particular chart shows the class of 2012 and their progress over the 6 years after they graduated. So the first year, we saw that 83% of them enrolled in colleges and universities. The second year, 8% were no longer enrolled, that's the gold band. 4% were newly enrolled, so of that 17% that were enrolled that first year, 4% more enrolled. 74% were still enrolled, and 1% had graduated. What we want to see over the next 4 years is more students in that dark green band that have graduated and received either associate's or bachelor's degrees. So in the sixth year, we can see that 36% of students from the class of 2012 have graduated with a degree from a college or university. 21% are still enrolled, so they're still taking courses at a college or university, and 33% are no longer enrolled. This next chart was on page 17 of your packet, and the blue and green bars were switched. So this is a correction. This chart shows the classes of 2007 through 2011 and the types of post-secondary institutions they attended. So overall, we can see that about 80% or 8 out of 10 of our students attend a college or a university within the first 2 years after high school. Most of them, if we look at the green, we can see they attend public universities. Traditionally, we've seen that slightly more students attend two-year, but for the class of 2011, two- and four-year are equally represented, and most of our students do attend California colleges and universities. When we look at trends in this data, we can see, though, there's a slight trend towards more students attending private, four-year, and out-of-state institutions. And the last slide we have here from the National Student Clearinghouse data is the most common post-secondary institutions for all of the students that we have submitted. So we started submitting with the class of 2007. So this represents the classes of 2007 through 2013. Not surprisingly, Cuesta, Cal Poly, and UCSB are our top three schools. There are also an additional 5 UCs and 5 CSUs in our top 15.
And I'm going to hand it over to Kim. Maybe I do.
Have a question?
Just a quick question on the EAP exams.
Yes.
AP and the classes and then the exams. Is there a cost associated with taking the AP exam?
Yes.
And do students who are unable for whatever reason to pay for that, is that sometime?
Yeah, students who qualify financially, so usually who receive free or reduced lunch, or they can also, their parents can sign a verification form, receive the test for $5 instead of, I'm drawing a blank, $86, I think it is this year. Does that sound familiar, Scott? It's $86 per test, but students who qualify for financial assistance only pay $5. The state and the College Board pick up some of that.
Thank you very much, Erin.
So what are we doing about this data? What are we doing to address it? In order to prepare our students to be college and career ready, we are focusing on changing our instructional practices. We're going to look at these five areas. So we'll look at teaching and learning in a student-centered classroom, what programs are in place for students to become college and career ready, assessment data and collaboration, curriculum, and technology. So the first one we'll look at is technology. So you're going to hear more of a technology update in a separate presentation, so I won't say too much about that. But to think about what is currently going on, we have some good pilot programs started. So we're looking at what are we doing to engage and excite students in the classroom, and how are we using technology in order to differentiate, in order to get tools in teachers' hands to help them to accelerate and to help them to reteach in a very engaging, exciting manner. We have some solid programs in place for college and career readiness. Career technical education is an example. We had the skateboard example tonight, right, that held up for you. So, you know, we're looking at what kind of skills do students need and how can we help prepare them for the world that they're walking into. Obviously, you heard the exciting data around Avid, so that we can take students that it's their first generation to be able to reach college, and for them to have 72% of those students ready when they leave high school for the courses they need in order to walk into college. Successful program there. And we have our early assessment program that Erin talked about that also addresses assessing but also preparing students for the English language arts and the math courses. They prepares them for the level and rigor of courses that they're going to need when they walk into in their first year of college. One example of a solid program that is in place that prepares students to be college and career ready is our STEAM program at Los Osos Middle School. So this example you're going to see is Mr. Hotelling's sixth grade STEAM class, where they're demonstrating a project-based learning. And what they've done is they've taken a project from the blueprint phase and progressed all the way through the construction phase of geometric prisms. And then they got to use those geometric prisms for some volleyball.
Pretty cool, huh? In the area of curriculum, elementary writing instruction is happening daily with our Common Core aligned rigorous program. We are piloting a math curriculum this year called Bridges in 20 of our kindergarten through second grade classrooms for possibility of adoption. We've developed and are now revising our kindergarten through sixth grade Common Core math units of study for our classroom teachers. Secondary math teachers are beginning the development of units of study as well. In fact, Barb Salitis and her team shared the first completed Common Core aligned statistics and probability unit with her second grade math teachers just last week. In the area of assessment, data, and collaboration, ongoing math workshops and coaching are happening at all grade levels. Our most recent January Professional Development Day provided time for teachers to collaborate, review assessment data, and revise plans in both writing and math. Our grading consortium is working hard to develop a new elementary report card system to be ready for the 2014-15 school year. Secondary English teachers attended a 3-day expository reading and writing professional development series. Our secondary teachers have been collaborating with writing assessment to improve student performance based on real student work. Our students are engaged in more rigorous math tasks, and teachers are noticing the shift in their math practices. The quotes you're about to read up here on the screen come from our teachers in reflecting about students' work at our most recent math scoring days, and I'll let you read them yourself. And finally, we end with some current highlights of the changing expectations and practices happening now with our teachers, principals, and most importantly, with our San Luis Coastal students.
What do you notice about these numbers when you look at them like this?
Oh my God!
5 is 25, 14 is 4, 6
becomes 3. Oh my God, they get it now!
1 becomes 2, 1 becomes 1.
That was so easy! Oh my God!
Times is itself. So what do we call that when we times a number by itself? We call them, that's the hard part, it's
perfect
squared.
It's a square. Six squared is 36. Very much. We'd love to answer any of your questions.
Mrs. Sheffer?
I didn't even get a chance to turn my light on. So I have a question about the kind of gap after third grade in reading. You know, it's kind of a big jump there. Does it have to do with the different texts that they're reading now, with the emphasis on nonfiction, with other kinds of written material, or what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that maybe a possibility of some of it, but the Common Core expectation, the rigor has gone up, and so we know that we need to teach our kids how to do what we call a deeper reading. They need to understand it better because it's not going to get easier. So I think it's more about the rigor and the expectation. Even as far down as kindergarten, the Common Core expectation is higher than what our past expectation was for students by the end of kindergarten. So we know we need to start in early and start really honing in on reading skills, which is why Darla had mentioned that this was our first year of actually giving our benchmark assessment system reading tests to our kids. Usually we begin it in January. We did it in fall this year to kind of set a message and to also get our teachers really going and paying attention to early reading behaviors to get them moving on so that we don't see that gap later in the upper grades.
So that gave them some guidance as to how to proceed through the year a little bit, a little more information as to here's where they are now and here's where we'd like them to be, or this is what we need to work on as we move forward. I mean, with that benchmark assessment.
Do you see what I'm saying?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I guess what I'm asking is if you had the benchmark assessment mm-hmm. and it showed the gaps, then it's kind of working to know what needs to be worked on, what needs to be beefed up, or if some teaching techniques need to be changed, or if the teacher needs to say, gosh, it looks like I need to know more about this.
Absolutely.
And we're directing our professional development in that.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the strategies that we are now emphasizing that's Common Core related is what's called close reading, and it's especially an important strategy, and I would say third grade on up, where you teach students strategies of looking at difficult text and how to find the most important parts of it. In fact, if you read our blog that went out this week and go to the EL page, there's an article specifically on close reading, what it looks like. Like, what are the strategies involved in it? But it's things like that that we think are going to help up that little piece. The other thing that's important for you to know for our students who are not yet proficient on the SRI, we give them an additional assessment. We give our students not yet proficient in third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade the benchmark assessment system so that we can do a more diagnostic view to figure out what it is they need and what support we can give them.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you, Jim. I just want to take one advantage just briefly here. What we're seeing is, if I get this right, we're seeing a lot of response to this new Common Core. Can you just give us a quick summary? Because I'm not sure I understand, but I'm not sure everybody else is understanding what's going on. Because this is really a response to a whole new way we're doing things.
That's a really big question.
Well, just this
And I'll give you the nickel and dime answer. Common Core is a new set of standards, as we all know, which if you teach the same way you're teaching before, it doesn't really make that big of a difference. But what we know, our new assessments are coming, the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, and the assessments are coming. And what we know about those assessments is that we're going to be asking our students to think deeper, work harder, prove their answers, and we can go in both areas, reading, writing, and math, do a lot more than just pick the correct answer on a multiple choice assessment. So I think it's probably fair to say that Common Core aligned with new types of assessments are really making the shift in our thinking about what kind of professional development we need in place, what kind of instructional coaching we need in place for our classrooms to really support our teachers make that change in instruction.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, thanks. And just part of my understanding is Common Core came down from the National Governors Council and through the colleges, and that now across the country we're basically teaching to the same standard? Is that roughly?
In fact, 45 of our states have approved the Common Core, and San Luis Coastal as well approved the Common Core as our curriculum.
So that's what we're working on.
Okay, absolutely.
Just within the document that we got, one piece really stuck out for me, and that's, and I don't know if we can get it up or not, but it's a K-1-2-3-4 all the way across high school, and it's the math, I'm going to call it a math continuum. And one of the exciting things for me was we're teaching some algebra in kindergarten.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then I'm going to make a guess here. So when a kid draws a square, that's not just a kid drawing a square. That's the geometry that's in kindergarten. Is that a guess?
Well put, Mr. Buckman, and if I have my way, you're going to see the word algebra on next year's kindergarten report card.
Oh, yeah. Well, I never would have made it out of kindergarten. But so I'm really excited because what we're seeing is this whole new approach where everything's connected all the way through K-12, it looks like, in math. Yeah, okay. And then I just
have... In fact, with that, I think as important as the standards themselves are the 8 mathematical practices that we've shared with you before and will
right.
continue to share with you, which are really about those habits of minds of our students, what we want them to do with the math, that thinking, persevering, making models, working collaboratively, very as important as the curriculum itself.
Okay. Former parent that used to try to avoid doing math homework with my two children, if I had known some of this, that like this was geometry that I was working on in second or third, fourth grade, I might have worked a little harder because I would have learned it, but then I would have been more impressed with the homework. So as we go through this continuum, is there a plan or some way that we're looking at to engage parents so that they know that in kindergarten? Is that a softball?
Thanks for the unintentional. So yesterday we held a parent information night at Laguna, and tomorrow night will be at Los Osos Middle School, so I invite anyone to attend. And what is happening at the middle school parent night basically shows parents, here's where the initiative came from that asked for a world-class mathematics program, and at the same time we have Common Core implementing that is a new level of rigor and absolutely ask for students to not be able to understand math at a basic level, frankly, like I and probably you learned math of just completing problems and cranking out an algorithm, but instead to be able to think at a deep level. And so these parent nights are helping parents understand the changes that are coming, but then the great thing is also walking them through examples, and there's actually manipulatives on the table that they'll then actually create things and learn how is this different. The other neat thing that's happening is it's showing parents examples of how we're differentiating, because instruction has changed. It's not always one teacher presenting the same information to 30 students, and so they're going to see real examples, and they're going to be involved in examples that show the different level of rigor, the higher expectations, what students are going to be expected to do, and then also how we're going to be able to better meet the needs of individual students. So I invite you to Los Osos tomorrow night.
I went to see L. Smith.
Great.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
I'd just like to say that I'm very pleased to see that 5% decrease in at-risk kinders, and obviously that validates the investment that we've made as a district in our preschools and our transitional kindergarten and in our other kindergarten program, our pre-K program. So it's just wonderful to see that, and thank you for those stats. It's helpful.
Well, thank you, Amy and Darla and Kim and Aaron and Jen, for all your hard work, and we appreciate the presentation. Okay. All right, we are about to move on to the public comment, and I do want to just read this a little bit at the moment. At this point in the agenda, the board welcomes comments on matters of district interest. The board will listen but cannot engage in discussion or take action on items not listed on the agenda due to the Brown Act. The total time for public comment is limited to 20 minutes at this time and 20 minutes on each agenda topic, and each speaker is limited to 3 minutes. Generally, in this section of the agenda is for individuals or representatives of a group to address the board on issues not listed on the agenda. Speakers who wish to discuss items on the agenda are requested to wait until the item comes before the board. However, comment may be given on agenda items at this time if it is not possible for a speaker to stay until the agenda item is heard by the board. So it would be nice if you filled out a form, and we will be visiting the Johnson Avenue project later in the agenda, but you may speak at this time if you wish to do so.
Everybody else is about John Day.
And right now we have three people who wish to speak under public comment at this time. And I'm going to name those people, and if you could be ready to approach the podium and please state your name when first off for the record. You'll have 3 minutes. I have a timer here, and a light will go on to let you know when your time is nearly up, and we'll be holding to the three-minute guideline here. So first I have, and please, I will apologize for mispronunciations right off the bat. First is Dia Hurd.
Yes, I wish to speak at the agenda item now that you moved it forward.
Oh, okay, then I will, all right. Then Wendy Brown, followed by Ron Tilley, who put question marks. Would you like to speak now, Mr. Tilley, at this time?
No. Well, yes, this is fine. Yeah.
Okay, so first.
Copy
agenda and I didn't, wasn't.
Okay, so first we'll have Wendy Brown. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a little bit of a departure from the EIR comments, which is why I asked to speak now. First of all, thank you for spending your time trying to solve difficult issues. I think we all appreciate that and know it's very difficult and hard. You have acknowledged the difficult issue of the dangerous traffic problems caused by high school drop-offs and pickups by commissioning the traffic study about that issue. The traffic study has many partial solutions, which altogether would cost over $1.5 million. I am asking you to implement as many of those solutions that you can afford as soon as possible and not to link them with the housing project. The safety of many people is at stake. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Next, Ron Tilley.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Chairman, or President, and board members. My name is Ron Tilley. I live at 1780 San Luis Drive, and thank you for letting me speak. It was very informative hearing the presentation earlier. I have a granddaughter who went through the AVID program, very thrilled about that, another granddaughter who graduated. So it's commendable for engaging young people. I was a pain in the neck when I was young, and I didn't even have a cell phone or text or anything. So thank you for all the good work you do. A few weeks ago, it came to my attention through the land use and circulation update that there's going to be some growth happening. And I also learned that the board here or the school district plans to sell off a piece of property for development, and that concerned me too. And so I don't know where exactly to start. I left my notes at home, but I guess what I would like to learn is what the process is for declaring land as excess and then what the state of California's role is, if any, in the selling of excess land. And because I can't help but believe that when the land was set aside for public facilities, that the intent was to use it for education. And I guess I have an issue with the Board of Education being involved with real estate development or marketing or whatever that is. That's my. And with this land use and circulation element update, it seems that there are areas in the city that are designated for residential development, and they're talking about hundreds of homes. And in all the data that I sort through, and I'm not very thorough, but I look through there, and there didn't seem to be anything where there was public facilities land being designated now in the planning process for future schools, because it always seems like the kids are here and the schools are there. So rather than giving up land here at the high school campus, now maybe that land could be used for a special little program or a science thing where you consider alternative energies or something. So that's one thing. And hundreds of homes at 1.8 per household. If I know the demographics aren't that accurate, but if you had 180 homes or 1.8 children, 100 homes. 180 kids divided by 20 kids per classroom, which I think Jack O'Connell liked as an average. That's 9 classrooms. That's an elementary school. So in my mind, for every 100 homes, you should be thinking about an elementary school. That's just me. Future crew, keep the land for the future. And maybe the board could ask the city to require landowners and developers to set aside public facility zone land for future school sites. So I'm at the caution sign. I don't think I have anything more intelligent to say. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And that's it for now.
So we'll close this public comment. Okay. Please come forward. Please come forward.
Mary Jo Devitt, San Luis Obispo. First of all, I'd like to compliment Mrs. Shields and her team on the excellent and informative presentation. In April, it will be 33 years that I have been an elementary school substitute teacher for San Luis Coastal. And I have had the privilege of seeing what a difference it has made to have Mrs. Shield in the position that she is. This fall, I was substituting in a 5-6 combination grade, and a math presentation was made by a gentleman who came from Portland, and they were apparently, his group was hired to give these presentations to the students as well as to the teachers. So he starts out, now we're back to the big sheets of white paper. So he puts down 6 times 10 on the paper. I don't want you to tell me the answer. he said. I don't want you to tell me the answer. I just want you to tell me what that means to you. Well, as these went on, you know, then it was 6 times 100, 6 times 1,000. It was just unbelievable to see the students. They, you know, at first they were a little timid, and then they just became more and more and more engaged. I became more and more and more engaged. So I'm sure there isn't any doubt in any of your minds what an excellent job Mrs. Shields and her team is doing. And I certainly know that Dr. Prater was very instrumental in seeing to it. As much as I was sorry to see Mrs. Shields leave her position as principal, I'm just so pleased. And in 33 years, I can honestly tell you, there have been some really big differences. I had Scott, I helped in his classroom when he was in kindergarten. Now he's a senior in high school. And I'm back to that same kindergarten class with another one of our grandchildren. And it is unbelievable to me to see the difference in the math. And yes, it is algebra. And yes, Mrs. Shields should get her way to say that it's algebra. But I've never felt the need to prepare to help in kindergarten before. But I'll tell you something. Come Sunday night, I'm thinking about Monday morning and what task she's going to give me, the teacher's going to give me for helping. And it's only a 30-minute period, and the other part I do, you know, running things off and what have you. But at any rate, thank you, Dr. Prater, and thank you, Board, for making the change that you made to put Mrs. Shields and her team in the position. It certainly has been well done by her. And my mother used to say, you know, do what you do best. And I'll tell you, this gal's doing what she does best. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. If there's no other further comment, we will move to the superintendent's updates, item 7.01.
So I'm going to keep mine brief tonight because we have a pretty stacked board agenda, but I just wanted to let the board know I was accepted into the FICMAT CBO Academy. So lucky me. I could start, you know, always going back to school, always learning. So I will be, I'll start up in April at the CBO. Basically, it's kind of the CBO big meeting in California, and that will take me all the way through the year. I believe it's a kind of a weekend a month type of thing, and off homework and the whole process. So, but I'm actually looking forward to it, and getting a mentor and kind of working with peers and kind of developing a cadre of professionals that I can talk to. So that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Mr. Robinette.
And for our Ed Service update, I'm going to defer to our Secondary Director of Learning, Achievement, Innovation, and whatever else, Kim McGrath, to give us a little update on some technology happenings.
Well, I'm here tonight with a fabulous team from both instructional and technology, so it's been a collaborative project, and I want to thank them for their hard work. So tonight we're going to update you on where are we with some big technology projects. Oh, don't you?
Yeah, push that and then no, click it. Of course, technology.
I like mine better. Of course.
Hold it down for 10 seconds. There you go.
It's just Murphy's Law, right? Yeah. So we're starting with where are we with technology, and what is our vision? What are we trying to accomplish? So when we look at
you know, why are we making these changes? And why are we, you know, having this progress? We're looking at, we want to engage students, and we want to create an excitement within a classroom. We want to make sure that we're preparing students for the college and the career world that they're going to walk into. And as we all know, the world now that they're going to need is around digital literacy. It's just going to be part of their learning that they need to be able to accomplish. Technologies, our goal is for it to allow teachers to be able to differentiate, to really put a tool in their hands that allows them to be able to have a different way to reteach and then to also be able to accelerate students. I'm going to show you a video here, and when I show you this video, I want you to, actually, no, this one is just an introductory video. No, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. Okay, so this is it. On this video, you're going to see an example from another district, and I want to make sure to focus you on the correct things for this video. So don't look at the fact that it's another district. Don't look at the fact that they picked a tablet, which tablet it is, the fact that they rolled out this particular tablet. Okay, don't get distracted by that. What I want you to focus on is, are they able to accomplish these things with their technology? Did they engage? Did they create excitement? And how have they been able to differentiate with technology? So look for those things in the video.
It's an amazing time to be in education right now. It's totally different than the classroom that we grew up in. It's the future.
I love being the superintendent of this district. We work with 7,400 wonderful kids. These children do absolutely remarkable things.
Every student in Hillsborough from K to 4 has their own personal tablet.
We decided to roll them out middle of the year, which is something you never do. And it was unbelievable how smooth and easy the rollout went.
Am I tech savvy? No.
I was personally ecstatic because I love technology.
We all got the tablets, and they took off with it.
Kind of spread like wildfire. They were taking it out and trying to figure out how to use it, and a lot of the kids were showing them how to use it.
You just press it, and then it opens. See?
When they have a tablet in their hands,
they become so much more engaged.
Things have completely changed in the way I teach. You're going to be choosing a math app that you like to practice, okay? Using the Google Play for Education store is very, very easy. It allows me to send out whatever app I've chosen to the entire group.
We have all our math apps here, our home screen here.
Apps for social studies, I found them for science.
I learned how to count money, how to spell stuff. It'll help me read books.
You could have some kids over here working on math, some kids here working on reading, and the teacher can get all this data instantly.
What's the answer, boys and girls?
70.
70, beautiful. Give yourselves a big pat on the back. Very, very good job.
Is that what you did? Did you click on that
one of the most wonderful things is individual instruction.
Nice. You're doing a really good job. On an app that we use today, no one in the room knew that they were all reading at a different reading level.
So I can be very specific to that one child, and that is absolutely amazing to me.
Let's see if you can problem solve it for me.
They loved to show me things, and they helped the others that were struggling with it. They became partners in the classroom.
Okay, open up your tablets, find it. I know you'll be fine.
It's no longer the special lesson. It's the new pencil. It's the new paper. It's the new book.
Students will be learning whenever they want, wherever they want, whenever it's convenient for them.
It's education everywhere at all times,
which is what a teacher's dream is. So,
some spectacular things can happen in classrooms.
So tonight we're going to update you on three components of technology. We're going to look at GAFI, which is Google Apps for Education, and where are we with that. We're going to look at websites and update you on where we are with that project, and elementary Wi-Fi. So first, Joe Miller from Technology. We'll start with Google Apps for Education.
Good evening. So we've been going through a lot of changes here. We've been looking at going to Google Apps, of course, like Kim just said. It requires a lot of different planning on different aspects. I'm having clicker trouble too. There we go. So we began looking back in August of 2014, actually even farther back than that, before Google was actually an application platform. But we've been looking at it for a while, over 6 months now. IS&T planning and testing, we've been doing lots in and out of the department to get ready for it. There's a lot of changes that will have to happen in the meantime. We've been doing that currently. We're right now in a pilot phase. As you heard a couple times, Los Osos is piloting it very successfully, actually. They've been doing that, I think, since September. We actually began their accounts in August. So we're right now in an account creation process, which is pretty big. It takes a lot of time to get all the student account information prepared and ready to go over there. That should be ready by the end of this month, we should say. Going forward, of course, in collaboration with ISLA, Instructional Services, we'll be creating some training committees and early adopters, taking some of those people from those pilot schools and sites that have been kind of testing it out and using them to help train the rest of the staff. And, of course, ISLA and Jen over here will update you a little bit more on that. We're going to use online training, a lot of great online things to help educate people, bring them up to speed on what's going on. Keep checking our IST blog. I noticed Mr. Quisenberry, you had posted to our IST blog. That's great. So keep checking there as well as on the EdTech and ISLA blogs. So we'll keep everybody up to date and let you know how things are going. Of course, then by the start of the 2014 school year, we plan to have all students and staff inside of the Google Apps platform, all of our internal services integrated with it. And at this point, we will kind of email will not be going for staff members, at least, to GroupWise anymore. We'll be using Google for an email application. And there'll be lots of other training available to get everybody up to speed, anybody have questions. And trust me, I have a lot of questions, too, as I can imagine everybody else does as well. So there'll be lots of questions and answering going on in between. So finally, last but not least, my favorite part, decommission GroupWise system in December of 2014. So at that point, we plan to have everybody off of it within the next year here, and at some point in December, maybe even the beginning of 2015, completely offline, and we'll be on the Google Apps platform. It'll be exciting. With that, I'll hand it over to Jennifer here. We'll fill you in more.
Alrighty. So I'm going to talk to you about what Google Apps for Education looks like in the classroom, and I went to Los Osos Middle School and had a student explain to me explain to you what's going on and how he uses several different applications for in the classroom every single day. So I'll just let you watch since 2 minutes.
Hi, my name is Theo Hendricks, and I go to Loam's. And today I'm going to be telling you how we use Google Drive in the classroom. So usually if I'm not signed in, like maybe I'm at home signing in, I'd type in Theodore S. Hendricks, and I'd type in my password, and then I'd be signed into Google. So once I'm here, I would, to access my Drive, which is where I keep all my documents and folders, I would click there and go to my Drive. And so now I'm at where I keep all my stuff. If I was, like, say, in Spindler's and I had just finished my independent reading, I'd go in my folder, and then I'd access my reading log, and just go to the bottom, and I'll just give an example here. Maybe I was, like, reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid, whatever, and I'd finish it, and there I'd put my author, how many minutes I read, how many pages, and then I'd be done. So after that, we'd create like a reflection on what we just read, say like the book Wonder that we finished in class, like we wrote a reflection on what we read. If I were to like finish a assignment on Google Docs, the way I'd turn it in is I'd be on like the doc, let's just pretend this is the doc, and I'd highlight all of this, copy it, and then I'd go to my teacher's website, and I'd go into assignments, and type in my first and last name, paste the URL, and submit it, and that's all there is to turning in the assignment.
So you just got to see an example of how he uses Google Drive, Google Docs, Google Sites, and Google Forms all every single day. So with that, we'll require training. And so our training plan for our district, we have three different layers. At the district level, We plan on training ed tech lead teachers and other teacher leaders from LOMS and other schools that are using this. And we want to utilize these trainers to provide all teachers and staff voluntary training of just the basic nuts and bolts like email and calendar. And we are tentatively scheduling some planning sessions for spring, summer, and then back to school. And then at the site level, we're also going to be providing training. And so we're going to be starting this year with ongoing regular trainings on how to apply these applications in the classroom with our EdTech lead teachers and other teacher experts. And then they will, again, go back to their sites and provide site-based training. And this will continue all throughout next year as well. And then also Google provides an online learning center. And this is a free resource that focuses on Google tools and how to use them for teaching and for learning. And the emphasis is on how to apply these tools in the classroom. And it includes how-to videos and some self-paced learning modules and quizzes. And so I'll show you a 30-second clip of what a training video looks like from Google.
Under the Create button, I can create a document, like a Word document, a presentation, like a PowerPoint, a spreadsheet like Excel, a Google Form, or I can create a Google Drawing, which is similar to Paint but has collaborative properties, so you might want to check that out. If you already have files, you can click on the button right next to the Create button to upload files. But I'm going to go ahead and create a document. And once you've created a document, what you need to do is click where it says Untitled Document, and it'll allow you to rename it.
So as you can see, that's just a quick snippet of some free resources that are available to all of us here. So, and I'd like to say that I think the sixth grader did a really good job as well. So we're developing experts as we go here. And like my partner Joe said, we have blogs available, and I know some of you are actually accessing these now. So on the left, you'll see the IS&T blog, and he's doing a really good job keeping us updated on what's going on in their transitioning. And he's focusing more on the technical side of it. And then on our EdTech side, I'm going to be focusing more on the training and how to access everything and implement it in the classroom. So with that, I'll let Kim come up for Wi-Fi.
So as you remember, you approved for us to get started on elementary Wi-Fi. So really excited about what that's going to offer. And you have elementary principals and teachers super excited right now. So far, we have created a vision and kind of analyzed our current situation, formulated our plan of the action that we need to take. We've walked a sample site in order to get a feel for where are we currently and began to modify internally our maps. And right now, I'm going to let Marsha Walther take over and just tell you a quick piece about where we are with CAD drawings and the construction process.
Good evening. My name is Marsha Walther, and I'm a construction manager and project inspector. Where we're at currently is we have enlisted RRM Design Group, who has worked with this district over many years to develop the baseline plans. Basically, it's just a site map of all the buildings, where all the classrooms are, all the spaces identified, so we can then look at them from the technology consultant and go, where do we need to put the access devices? Where do we need to upgrade as far as infrastructure? So we just started that process. We just walked the first three school sites that we had the most current information on. And basically, we're breaking it up into three different packages based on, in all honesty, what information we had and could easily get things going the quickest. As I know, Kim would like to have this up and running in August. So that's what we're working towards.
Thank you. Last piece, did you have a quick question? Last piece to update you on is websites. So we have a fabulous project going on. We did a thorough research of some great companies and selected iTech Solutions, which happens to be a local company, and they're doing an amazing job. So the first step of the process is the company analyzed our own data internally and looked where people are visiting on our websites and brought to us a paper version and said, this is what the data is showing about where people are going on your websites. And so here's just a beginning skeleton of what we think based on what the need is of what it might could look like. So then I began gathering groups for input, and we've gathered information at the district level, at the high school, middle school, and elementary. And so after that first step, then we have created the second step. They have sent this first draft. So this is just a very first draft, and we still need to gather a lot of input. But what we're aiming for is a modernized, progressive look in our websites that communicates and gives the message of what the type of message that we want to present about our district. So we also want to look for something that's aligned, because we want to make sure we look like we're all part of the same family, right? So you can see here's a district sample, Morbay's sample, middle school sample, and an elementary sample. So just today I sent these out to all the principals and said, please begin to gather input from your staff and from your sites, and so we'll begin that second step. Great. So exciting things happening in technology. Any questions? Go for it, Scott.
Scott.
Hi. Scott hung around for this.
Just real quick. I know Slow High, we just revamped our website, and it doesn't look like that. Will we be changing ours?
We will not.
Okay. Just curious.
It's a good question, Scott. It was sort of one I was thinking about asking. What effect will this will have on each school's individual website?
Yeah. Right. So Slow High, we looked at their format and talked to the company about that. We want to make sure they still look like they're part of the same family type of thing. But obviously, since they just redid it, we wouldn't waste the money to do that again. And so, yes, those are samples. That is, we're only at the second of eight steps. So that's just a sample. So, for example, at the middle school, it's only an example of Laguna. So now Laguna and Los Osos will look at that and give us input about. And then same thing for elementary. They've only created Baywood as just a draft and first look at it. So now all the elementary sites will give us input about what they want their elementary website to look like.
Thank you very much, Kim, and thank your crew. They've great job, and it's exciting times we're heading into.
It is. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. We are now moving on to a public hearing on the health and family living supplemental materials. So later in this agenda, the board will be asked to consider new supplemental materials for health and family living curriculum. And at this time, the chair will open public hearing, provide an opportunity for comment on materials. And Mrs. Shields, did you have? I think so. It is open at this time. So if there's anyone who would like to come address the board on the health and family living supplemental materials. Okay. Seeing no one, we will close it. Okay. So that brings us to item 9.01, and that was a shift in the agenda. And we are moving item number 9.09, which is the Johnson Street Project EIR.
Yeah.
And Mr. Pinkerton.
Yes. So here we go. So we're all here today. A lot of our neighbors, I believe, are here tonight to kind of hear our conversation as well as give some input, which I think is fantastic. This is the first time the board has had the opportunity since the draft EIR has come up, basically, has been released to actually even talk about this item. The city did have a meeting last Thursday night. And I want to say it was a city meeting that they put on, that they organized, and they kind of put together. It was held here at one of our adult ed classrooms. And so, unfortunately, that probably made it look like it was a school district meeting as well, but it wasn't. That said, I think their intentions were good in that they wanted to get the information out about the EIR and some of the traffic mitigations, those things. But I will tell the board that the meeting didn't start out well. It I think the neighbors really just wanted kind of a timeline and some general information about the project and what's going on, and just kind of to sit for a minute and you know, get 15 minutes of just what's happening. And unfortunately, the city staff didn't do that. And it caused some negative reaction amongst the groups, and to be honest with you, I don't blame them. I think it probably wasn't delivered the way it should have been. So so that said, it is what it is in terms of their meeting. They went there. I was there. I talked to a few people as they went by and tried to answer questions on my behalf. But, again, it was a city meeting, so I didn't feel like I could take over that meeting and kind of redirect it and do those things. So basically what they did was they set up four different kind of boards, basically, one about the traffic mitigation project in terms of what would have to happen for the Johnson Street. Carol Florence was there with just kind of a general synopsis of the project itself. There's another table where they actually kind of talked about the loose aspect of it with other things going on in the city. And then there was another table that actually talked about some of the things they've already done, because they have done some mitigation aspects. And so for me, the whole meeting really became kind of a lost opportunity for us to, you know, kind of lay things out and start on a positive, communicate from that aspect. And so thus, you received a bunch of letters over the past few days. And so, you know, I apologize for the tone in some of those letters, to be honest with you. But it comes with the office, I'm sure, in some ways. But it's unfortunate because it really didn't need to get to that point. I think we need to communicate. So after tonight, I will be hopefully talking to the neighbors and setting up a meeting on behalf of the district that we can hopefully answer any questions that they have, because we want this to be a process where we get their input and transparent, and there's nothing we're hiding and going through that. So after I'm done with this and as we leave, I'll try to set that up with them. Kim, if you can put the timeline up. Yes,
excuse me,
go ahead.
For a second, Brian. could you just give a nutshell what we're doing, because we've already heard some misinformation about selling property and things.
So I'm going to walk us through a timeline right now of why we're here today, why we're even talking about a draft EIR Johnson Street project. So it's a great point. So I just wanted to start that, because I know many of the neighbors, it was a poor meeting, unfortunately. So but this is kind of a timeline, which I, you know, kind of share to go back. So this started back in 2005. So we went through some really tough budgetary years in the early 2000s, where we had to shut down school sites, you know, massive revenue. We needed revenue. And so because of that, the board at the time looked at all of our properties and what could we do with those, and what are the properties we're using, what are we not, because we were ultimately end of the line is we need revenues to run our programs, run our schools for our kids, so that we can do all those projects that we just have been seeing for the past hour, right? So a 7-Eleven committee was formed in 2006 and basically looked at the sites, its city, its some members even here in the audience tonight were part of that 7-Eleven committee, and basically through that process, they determined that parcel, the Johnson Street parcel, was surplus property, that it wasn't going to be used for a school facility. And again, so initially as it goes through, you begin to talk about that. What are the impacts? What are we going to do with those projects? Initially, the district looked at putting 14 estate-sized lots in that area. Okay, it makes sense. You know, not too much of a, hopefully, a huge impact on where things are at. I believe in talking to Carolyn again, I've come into this with Mr. Miller, you know, a little bit, but kind of have taken over the past you know, 6 months, basically, to where we're at today. But so again, so the lots, so the 14 lots, we take that to the city. We go, they, you know, we submit it. We get a huge response, basically, back of issues and problems and things, and it didn't look favorable in terms of that they were going to at that time pass our kind of move us forward doing the 14 estate size lots. So with that, a few things happened during that time. And so as it's listed from 2008-2009, a few laws came down, state mandates for cities, where they were supposed to add multifamily units. And basically, it was kind of a pro-environmental push to have people walk to work and ride bicycles and less cars on the road. And so the city has to kind of tell the state, hey, we're going to put so many multifamily units within the general plan and looking at those things. And so those discussions happen with the city. And I believe kind of, hey, help us out with the city plan. Now, again, we have different city managers now. We have a different city staff now. This is 2008, so 6 years ago, right? And so a lot has changed in terms of personnel and those things. However, I would say with kind of the city's blessing in some ways that we move forward with kind of a more of a R4 multifamily unit structure. And so that's what we did. Go ahead. And Carol, you can jump in if
can
I
you
miss anything.
Can you hear me? So it put another way, would you say that our original executive lot concept was not well received by the city, but that the city wanted to have higher density infill?
I would say that the city, you know, based on state mandates that were put down on the city, that they had to come up with areas within the city limits that would meet those state requirements.
So the high density was the city's.
I'll have Carol.
Was the city's desire?
Yes.
Hi, Carol.
Thank you, Carol Florence. It's nice to see you again. I think you can see that there was a shift in thinking because of the state mandates. The property had been in the city's housing element, which is one of the elements of their general plan, and identified as an area that was underutilized, if you will. So they have been looking at properties throughout the city to see if they could implement infill and compact urban form, walkability in their communities, et cetera. So it was a natural progression, if you will, to go from something that was very less dense to something that was higher density.
Thank you.
So as you can see, you know, there were some meetings held in the fall 2009 with community groups throughout to kind of talk about this and use of the property and moving forward. And then in 2010, we submitted our second application to the city with the 88-unit residential. So as you part of this, I think the issue is that it's taken so long to get to this point where they actually have just now given, you know, put out the draft EIR, that there's a lot of confusion about the project and misinformation and what's going to happen and are they building a road behind the high school. And there's all of these things that are happening that, you know, we need to clarify and we need to make sure all of our neighbors, because we want to be good neighbors, understand kind of what's happened, where we're at in the process. So I think those are important things. So that said, the city has, you know, through that you can see kind of the initial studies. The EIR began. We went with a full EIR at the time. The city has begun some traffic mitigation within the area. So I believe right off of Fixolini, they put a kind of a you can't drive through, you have to turn left. So hopefully kind of stopping some of that high school traffic drop-off pattern that's going on. At the same, I would say, as I've just gotten into it as of last year and kind of coming in too, we actually went forward and we did another traffic mitigation study. So the district paid for another traffic study based on recommendations from the city staff to really make sure that our analysis of traffic mitigation, that it was correct, that it's right, and so. Because I believe as neighbors come up, that's going to be the major concern, right? As we've heard a little bit tonight, but it's traffic, and the amount of traffic on Johnson, on Lizzie, on Fixolini, on all those streets. How are we going to handle that? And so that's basically that traffic study went through that process, and Carol's going to talk a little bit about what's in the EIR and what the EIR says, and give you an update. So again, the draft EIR just came out. It's posted on the city website. I read through it. It's 831 pages, 880 pages, something like that. And so at this point, I think it's probably a good time for Carol to kind of walk you through the EIR with what's in the EIR, and we can answer questions about that. And then I want to kind of maybe, you know, give the board kind of a here's where we're going to go from here type of thing, and what the next steps are and the public comment period and those types of things.
Okay. Mr. Millar. Ryan, you mentioned expenses, the additional traffic study, et cetera. What is the source of those funds for us? Are they general fund monies?
General fund.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Carol Florence, again. It's nice to see you all. The last time we spoke was in September of last year, and I had told you that the EIR was going to be out for public consumption in November. Kind of missed that date, but here we are. January 24th is actually the date that it was finally distributed for a 45-day review period. In your information packet, there is an executive summary, and that's exactly what it is, an executive summary. But I just wanted to go through, first of all, to tell you that CEQA, or the California Environmental Quality Act, is a very rigorous law that looks at the environmental impacts of a project. So to start that process, interestingly enough, I should say that the EIR is kind of the highest level of document that you can create. Unavoidable adverse impacts that there is no mitigation for. Many times projects will come forward with Class 1 impacts, but it's up to the decision-making body to weigh the benefits of that project and those Class 1 impacts and perhaps override, they're called overriding consideration, to move that project forward. I am so thrilled because we're on pins and needles because the EIR process, the way it's administered through the city, we really don't have any ability to participate in that process. So we don't know what it says until everyone knows what it says. So I'm here this evening to tell you that we have no Class 1 impacts. Huge. Wonderful. This is the best document that we could have. So other than Class 1, there are Class 2. Those are impacts that are identified as significant, but that we can find mitigation measures for. So the other thing I wanted to bring forward, that this is an environmental document, starts with an E. What it isn't is an economic analysis, but this environmental document is very important for our understanding about the potential costs that are associated with the mitigation measures. So we've gone through the issue areas. I won't go through each of these. But I tell you what class they are, how many mitigation measures, and in your spare time you can just kind of read through the little synopsis. I will just underscore, as Ryan mentioned, that the top issue seems to be transportation and circulation. Again, Class 2, mitigable, with 12 mitigation measures associated with that. And in the back of your packet, there's an aerial photo. The city, actually, that was a board at their Fixlini meeting last week, that identifies those areas that we're talking about within the mitigation measures themselves. They also discuss alternatives, ranging anywhere from the no project alternative. CEQA mandates that you look at that, and I give you brief descriptions about the essentially five alternatives that the EIR also looked at. So really the next step in the process, Ryan's gone over the somewhat of the project timeline with you when we started back in 2006, and that was somewhat of an answer to Mistress Tilly's question, how do you take a piece of property and determine that it's surplus? You're bound, as you well know, by the education code and all of the requirements within that. So not only are you working under the education code, but now going through the city, you're going through all of the city regulations as well. So fast forward, January 24th, the city issued the draft EIR. Typical public review period is 45 days. We will be, as well, reviewing this document with a fine-tooth comb and preparing a written response to the document on your behalf. As we go through this, we have a series of public hearing, and if there's one thing I think that we have been in this process, it's very transparent. And it's a very participatory kind of process. If someone wants to come and speak or write a letter, they can. And there's many opportunities and milestones, from now until the end of this process. Our next stop will be February 10th at the Architectural Review Commission. Realizing that our request of the city was to rezone the property, but we did because we are, the district is part of this community. We care about what the project's going to look like. We established architectural and landscape architectural guidelines so that the development, I'll call partner at this point, comes in and has a very clear idea of what the district's expectations are, as well as the city's. So we'll go to the ARC and talk about those guidelines. The developer will ultimately have to take their project back through the ARC for another look. The Planning Commission will have an opportunity to discuss the draft EIR. That's scheduled for February 26th. The end of the 45-day review period is March 10th. We'll have the Planning Commission hearing in April. We'll have a second Planning Commission hearing, just from everyone's experience, that's usually what it takes. Planning Commission will ultimately make a recommendation to the City Council. The City Council makes the final decision. And we attempted to schedule that, not me, I just tried to get them to schedule that before the school year was really over. So that is slated for June 10th. But we have a lot of work to do from now until June 10th. Again, opportunities to get our message out, which we desperately would like to do, and I think we have been doing since we started this process. So with that said, if you have any questions of me, I'm more than happy to answer those. I just want to thank you again for your patience. It's been a very long process, but it sounds like through your educational processes and your upgrades of your technology.
Hear their concerns, let them kind of know our story, where we're at, those types of things. I think we should expand the comment period. Though it's 45 days here, we can talk to the city about expanding that comment period. So I think that's probably a good idea to allow extra time for people to give comment and as part of this process. So it'll push it out a little bit in terms of June, but I think the more we can allow the public to be part of the process, the better. So those are two kind of key things that I believe we should do. The board actually allowed me to go out and do an RFP for this project, so a request for proposals to begin to talk to developers. Because in the end of the day, I think for as a board, this is a revenue source. That was the whole purpose of us even going through this process, right, was to get revenue for our district so that we could have programs for our kids. So for us to move forward, we need to know, is this project worth doing? Is it a revenue enhancement that is worth putting a number of homes, whatever that ends up being in the end of the process that we go through? So we waited for the RFP and talking to council and talking to Carol, because we really didn't know until that draft EIR came out what the mitigations were going to be. Because if that EIR came out with some really high-cost mitigation items, the project's done. It's not going to make enough revenue to make it worth doing the project. So that said, the draft EIR is out now. I think if we extend that comment period, I've been talking to Carol as well as our council about there's a few companies that will kind of come in and do some revenue, not necessarily go to developers and have them develop it out, but they'll give us an estimate about what the revenue potential is for this project. And so that's something that I think it's an important aspect for the board to know what that's going to be. So I'd like to, during this extra time period, maybe with comments, having the meeting with the public, that I'll go forward and get that information to share with the board so that you can make a better decision about the process itself. So those are kind of those are the key things I would say in terms of where we're at and what I would like to do to kind of help facilitate the process itself. And I think important things for us to consider as we move forward. So there are some key things with the traffic mitigation. And so we're talking about putting roundabouts in front of Slow High. We're talking about stopping all access to students and parents coming up to the district. So in developing that, so I want to make sure the board understands, if we build it, these are the things that we have to do to mitigate those. Now, the traffic mitigation plan that's put out, that professionals put together to look at it, it basically, by changing the traffic pattern and doing the things that they've told us in the plan, it actually supposedly makes the traffic a little bit better in terms of on these streets and through Johnson. So that's what the traffic study is telling us. Now, people are going to have concerns with that, and whether they believe that or not, or how that's going to, you know, those are, and that's part, I guess, going to the Planning Commission, listening to what people have to say. So there's going to be a lot of public comment time for people to be able to share their concerns with that study, with how things go, and I will just, as I go to those planning meetings, as I go to the city council meetings, those types of things, as it's come up, I will make sure that I let the board know what's happening, so that you're educated and you know, you know, basically what the public is saying, what our neighbors are saying, and what the city is saying as well.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Thank you, Ms. Florence. We are now going to open this. Do we have any more questions from the board? No. Okay. Dr. Eisenrath-Roger, question for Mrs. Florence.
Mrs. Florence, I was not on the board in 2005, and so I don't have personal knowledge of this. And so I'm unclear in everything that I've read and heard about this, about what exactly happened with our 14-unit presentation with the city. Were we asked not to go forward with that, or was that taken off the table?
You want to pull the timeline back up again?
The city wanted the high density.
I'll just have you focus on the when we first lodged that permit application in May of 2008. Okay. Typically, when you do that, the city has 30 days to either deem the application complete or provide you with a list of questions, because you need to provide additional information. We ended up with a very, very lengthy list of comments, concerns. Again, the city themselves were going through an update of their housing element. They were attempting to comply with the state mandates, which really are all about air quality issues that are translated. We said, how are we going to do this if we can't spread out? We're going to have to be more compact, and with that, we're going to have to go up.
I see. Thank you for that clarification.
You're very welcome.
Thank you again, Mrs. Florence, and thank
you,
Mr. Pinkerton. And now we'll open this up to the public comment. I'd like to remind that each speaker has 3 minutes. And Mrs. Sheffer, can you start?
Again, please come on up. Be prepared to come up to the podium. And again, I will apologize for any mispronunciation. So first we have Dia Hurd, followed by David Kuykendall, followed by Eric Meyer, and then Stanley Schloss.
Hi. Good evening. My name is Dia Hurd. I have no idea where to begin. This is the most overwhelming EIR I've read in a long time. I have problems starting from the very beginning, which were just now slightly addressed. I think the dearth of information about this project is its biggest problem for me. I can't believe that you went to the city and they told you to create, you know, four-story buildings to save some grass. I mean, this was the first time I heard that. And the next point, I think, is why did they think that was appropriate to have all of these multiple buildings on the property when you could have actually, with your 14 houses, actually stayed clear of that and made that part, you know, a recreational area or something along that line. I don't understand this. Private apartments and public owners doesn't right, you know, it's not right for me. The official traffic count, I was told by the city, was actually starting today. So I don't know how we're doing anything with this, you know, kind of quickie little EIR traffic count that we did in 2012, according to the EIR. I just am so concerned. I don't believe, you can say what you want, but I don't believe, having lived here 7 years, you already have my letter, that you could mitigate this. You just can't mitigate that tiny little intersection at Johnson, Lizzie, San Luis, and going under and around a curve under the viaduct. They also say that it's five lanes on Johnson. I don't know where the five lanes, unless they're talking about the little two-car turn lane. I just have so many comments, it's ridiculous, but I'll just try to keep them. I don't know who you are, Ms. Florence. Can you tell me who you work for, please?
No, just make your comments.
Thank you. I understand. Was there any serious discussion of not making four-story buildings with the board? That's a question I have for you. Was that red, or are we going to yellow? Can you tell me?
You have 52 seconds.
Thank you. When the city chose higher density, you just went along with that, I guess, at the rate we're looking here. Okay. One of the biggest problems we've had in this city of getting down Johnson, and I do live on off of Johnson, is when the water mains break or when they need replacing, it stopped the traffic at this intersection. Pretty much stopped the traffic at this intersection when that happened last year, a couple years ago. What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? I think there's more problems with this project than are even mentioned in that EIR at all. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is David Kirkendall. First of all, I'd like to say that high-density housing in this particular area is contrary to the vision of the city as outlined by the circulation plan. Specifically in the area of cut-through traffic and the volume of traffic on Collectors. I live on Pismo. We have tried to mitigate for the last 8 years the traffic in this area, primarily caused by the high school, but the lack of access to arterials caused cut-through traffic. Putting 580 cars, additional cars, is contrary to the city's vision of the circulation plan, not increasing traffic, balancing traffic so there's a balance between pedestrian traffic as well as bicycle traffic and automobile. Concentrating all of the housing in this area violates that particular vision. There are places in the city to put high-density housing. I'm not against that. Railroad over by the railroad is a really good example. There's access to the arterials. There's quick access to stores. But this area is not one that lends itself and has been a chronic problem for the last 10 years that I know about, and that's only because I lived here 10 years.
Thank you. Eric Meyer.
Hi, my name is Eric Meyer, and I'm a current county planner, anybody who knows him anymore. One of his favorite sayings was, always wear a suit and tie, and nobody will ever ask you to lift anything. And that was pretty funny. We ended up making about 600,000 T-shirts with that on one of my companies. I learned a lot out of school. Another thing I got was that one of my high school teachers, Mrs. Nasha, taught art, and she always said, leave now, sleep when you get there. And that was something that drove me to entrepreneurialism. School and everything the way it's going now is pretty positive. I'm pretty excited about that. I'm pretty excited about your jobs. I'm not excited about this part of your job because this is difficult, and people like me coming up here to pitch at you probably isn't much fun to hear, so I apologize. But I was a planning commissioner when this project came through the planning commission, and we didn't see any of the 14 lots. We just saw the 88 units, and we made our comments about the 88 units. I had no idea that the 14-lot idea was the original idea. So the question at hand is basically that the city is who we're talking about. The city made us do that. Well, when you talk about the city, in this particular case, there was no public. The Planning Commission didn't say anything about that change from low density to high density, nor did anybody else other than city staff. So a few staff members at the city, whose subjective opinions may have been this or that, have dramatically swayed your project one way or the other. And just because staff says something, they're not God. They're just staff. They're just like anybody else. And so they can suggest that the project might not do this, they might not do that. But really it's the public's responsibility and the council's responsibility and the planning commission's responsibility to vet the project. And so I would suggest that you guys vet the project that you really want for the site rather than vetting a site that some staff may have suggested is appropriate.
Thank you. Stanley Schloss, and then, and then Hannah Novak.
Hi, my name is Stanley Schloss, and before making my comments about the project, we were sitting here listening to part of the educational agenda, and our children are long out of school, but it's very impressive to see the dedication on the part of all of you to the educational process, and also to hear your staff and your educators speak as well. So it gives us a lot of hope for the future when I think of the educational facilities and all the technology now that goes into educating our students. It's very refreshing. Having said that, my wife and I live on Fixlini Street, 1709, in the judges' cottages, which is right next to the immediately adjacent to the project that you're contemplating. And we're very much opposed to the Johnson Avenue housing project based on the negative impacts that I've heard about because of the scale of the project. Negative impacts on the overall quality of life for the surrounding community and for ourselves as immediate next-door neighbors. The density of the project requires an amendment to the general plan use map, and density is the genesis of many of the resulting problematic issues that have been brought out: traffic, noise, air quality. And what I don't quite understand is that under the current zoning, 12 dwellings per acre are permitted under the medium density zoning that's allowed. Why do you have to go to over 20 dwellings per acre? I mean, you're allowed to do 12 dwellings per acre. So I just don't understand why you have to expand this effort to such a degree. You're more than halfway there with what is available right now. Also, something that hasn't come up is, you know, the parking lot that the school district has out here has 80 or so parking spaces. I tried to count them, and it seems like it's 80 or so on the main parking lot. This project contemplates 192 vehicle parking. That's more than double the parking area that you've got out there, all underground, going to a depth of 38 feet.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hannah Novak.
Hi there. My name is Hannah Novak, and I live on San Luis Drive. And I too appreciate the hard work that you guys have done, and that continue to do in the difficult street of five. There is a constant traffic jam at the intersection of San Luis Drive and California. I noticed that the IR is suggesting that a traffic circle be constructed at the intersection of California and San Luis Drive, although that is not identified and mentioned in the project summary that was submitted before you tonight. I have concerns about the timing and the cost. That's just distribution of 2% of total volume. I wonder where the 2% came from in terms of, it says that the project contributes 2% of the total volume of traffic. However, there's so many discrepancies with the EIR. If you go back to the EIR, it shows that there are over, sorry, I'm not that organized, 585 estimated daily vehicle trips being proposed on San Luis Drive, which is over more than double the amount of daily vehicle trips that currently travel on San Luis Drive. And I live there, and I know how difficult it is to get in and out of that little intersection currently without the proposed project. I also have some issues with regard to timing of some of the improvements that are being suggested in the EIR. It talks about allowing the school district 10 years to come up with the funding for the construction of the improvements. I have a real hard time seeing how in 10 years the construction of the roundabout would potentially mitigate the impacts of a currently proposed project. I could go on and on, but I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one more speaker, and that is Robert Lucas.
Thank you. I also live on San Luis Drive, and I just wanted to add to some of the comments made earlier. I'm glad the question was brought up about the medium density. I don't know why we jumped from 14 single homes to going to the maximum density of 88 when we could have 44 units. And presumably that would bring in some revenue, and that would cut down on the traffic considerably. It might also cut down on the number of people who are living in it per unit. That much I can't be too sure about. I also want to talk about, because it was not mentioned on the list of issues, that roundabout that is going to be proposed for California and for San Luis Drive. As Hannah mentioned, it's a busy corner, as I'm sure you know as well. And as I talked with the traffic engineers at the meeting on Thursday night, they said that they had not really adequately considered the impact on the pedestrians, and that's the ones that we really do worry about. It's the students who are crossing there. And when we try to get out there at the hour when you should not be going through, about 3:15 or so, we know that all traffic comes to a halt when a student enters that intersection, and that's as it should be. But that's the main holdup for traffic, it seems to me, is students who are crossing, and we want them to walk to and from, and we want them to be able to use that area, and it's a very tricky thing. It's now the traffic engineers said that they were going to route student footpaths so that was on the north side of the street rather than the south side of the street, and so it would consequently go around. And I think that's a good idea. I don't think it's going to work in practice. They are probably not going to cross at the intersection at Marsh there, because that's a dangerous intersection to cross. I don't cross there myself if I can avoid it in any way. So there is that issue. The other is the roundabouts. As we all know, they're new to us, and we're going to have new drivers, 16, 17-year-olds, who are going to be using the roundabout as well. I think that's going to add to the issue. So I just want to make sure that was part of your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more speaker.
This will be our last speaker under our time constraints, and that is, it's hard for me to read, Laurel Aver?
Davar.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening. I am going to just summarize a letter that I sent to the city about this. The EIR is significantly narrow, and in the meeting last week, I questioned the people who did the EIR is going to significantly impact that. There's no mitigation provided for that. There's no mitigation provided for the expanded traffic from other neighborhoods where developments are currently going on in Orchid and the other end of town, where people are trying to reach the freeway coming down Johnson. Take into account also that the water mains and gas lines get cut up along Johnson, and this is going to just completely snarl up this area. And I cannot believe that this EIR is addressing some of the minutiae, but failing to notice that there is more to it than just this project. And I recommend the 14 residential units or the 9.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes the public comment on item 9.01, well, actually 9.09, the Johnson Street Project EIR. I'm going to request a little 10-minute break here, if possible, and then we'll proceed. We are on item 9.01, the monthly LCAP review. I believe, well, that's a good question. Is there any board discussion on item 9.09, the Johnson-Avo project? Any questions that board members have to staff? Mr. Millar.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what we embarked on way back in, where's my timeline, 05, which where we the board decided that we needed to examine trying to put some surplus properties to the highest and best use we could figure out. So why we started this process was to have, I don't know what the proper term is, but to have this piece of property that went through the 7-Eleven process and was determined to be surplus, credentialed appropriately through the city and the planning apparatus so that it could be available for a development, lease development at its highest, best use, appropriate with all the controlled constraints. So I'm just worried that some members of the public have got this notion that we're, you know, we're going to sell it. That's not the case. It's going to be a long-term lease, as I understand it, and that it will provide ongoing revenue stream to the general fund, which was the primary goal of the board when we made this decision. So none of that's changed. We're still trying to achieve the same outcome. And I appreciate the input from the public and those who couldn't stay a little bit longer in this process, but that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to become real estate landlords or, you know, property moguls or anything. We're trying to supplement the general fund so that those inspiring things that many of you got a chance to see tonight, which I'm very grateful for, can continue to be funded. So have I got kind of the right lock on this thing? Okay, I see some nodding heads over there. Not sure we'll pick that up on TV, but that's okay. So, Dr. Prater?
I'll take a swing at this. What you said, Mr. Millar, is exactly true. That was the board's directive, as far as I understand it, back in 2005 when, or before even then, to maximize the use of our properties, and in such cases where we're not using certain pieces properties, that we can find alternative revenue streams so that we can fund educational programs. And we're trying to go through those channels, the proper channels, and adhere to processes that will allow us to do that. So I think what you've said is exactly true. The scope of the project, the unintended consequences of the project as it currently is, that's what I think is getting the attention. And quite frankly, good questions were raised. We need more information. We need far more data than we have now. And we will bring that back to you for further discussion. That's kind of how I look at it. I see enhanced revenue as part of our responsibility, when and where we can achieve that.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Prater.
So we can talk to people and gather additional information and concerns and suggestions, as well as have more information to present as we go forward. So those numbers are not carved in stone.
They're not. And if the board so chooses, I will communicate with the city staff tomorrow that we would like to extend the 45-day review period. I'll work with Mr. Pinkerton to come up with what we believe is going to be a reasonable amount of time to conduct the things that we need to conduct to bring information back to the board. I think the city will probably breathe a sigh of relief, because on your behalf, my job is always to attempt to facilitate not only the project moving forward, but in an expeditious fashion. So those are not hard and fast numbers. 45 days is the minimum public review period. So
So then I guess I would look to my fellow trustees to see if they're in favor of extending the 45 days, just so that we can all have some additional information. I don't know how what the formality would be for that.
I'd be in favor of that.
So it's consensus by the board.
Yes, I think it is.
Okay.
I think it is consensus. Mr. Buckman and then Mr. Millar.
Thank you. After hearing about the meeting that the city conducted, I'm very excited at this point to hear that the district is going to be stepping in, and not stepping in what the city stepped in, but stepping in to hold some meetings to gather information on our own. And I also have a question, maybe, Carol, and I don't know if this goes to you or not. Okay. A lot of work's gone into this. There's been a lot of numbers. There's been a lot of, you know, counting of cars and all that kind of stuff. So if the scope of the project were to change, can a lot of that work still be recouped and used?
That's a really good question.
Oh, thank you.
The threshold level, if you will, is established now at 88. So, for example, anything below that threshold level, because that's what the document was based on, would be considered insignificant, if you will, based on that threshold level. So if you were to say to me, well, Carol, I'd really like to have 188, that would be a different story. But that established, again, the upper maximum of that threshold level.
So just to be – so if the board were to say we want something that was less dense, then a lot of this work that's already been done can be applied to the
– Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Millar.
Carol, is it worth having the city revisit the purple needle grass issue? I mean, the one comment the gentleman made about, hey, they're only staff. So, which, of course, that's exactly how I feel here as well. The question is serious. Is it worth having them revisit? It would sure change the dynamics.
Well, it's certainly one, and I'm more than happy to ask that question, but that has been the standing, recommendation from the natural resource manager moving forward. Mm-hmm. Because of that, there were other, if you will, concessions made by the planning director at the time about how the project was actually relelocated on the site itself. So there were a number.
There was a little give and take.
There was absolutely give and take.
Grass, yeah.
And I also want to say, in defense of city staff, as well as all staff members, that one thing you do want to do as an applicant, and especially on your behalf, is to walk down the aisle, if you will, somewhat arm in arm. You want staff to support your project to their decision makers, to the people that will ultimately make that final decision about your project. So it's not as if there's something happening behind closed doors. It's a very open process, but it changes as time goes by and new information comes out. This project has been pushed and pulled in so many different ways. While I'm still trying to maintain, you know, that best and highest use, because it is about revenue enhancement. So
great. Well,
and I suppose it's not over until it's over. So we're more than happy to bring additional information back to you, whether it be environmental or economic information, because my job on your behalf is to provide that information for you to make good decisions.
Thank you. Are there any more questions by the board? Okay, seeing none, we're going to move on to item 9.01, the monthly LCAP review.
I just saw the programs. A lot of that is based on the initiatives, I would say, and a lot of the work that we've done over the past few years with the initiatives that Rick goes through. Rick then discusses kind of where we think we're going. Where are we headed in the future? So in kind of priorities with, you know, everything from one-to-one per student, looking at teacher time in the day, and, you know, lots of different ideas. And so from that, then Kristen Newland comes up. She begins to take input from staff. So what are their ideas about things that we should be doing in their district? What do they like about what we're doing now? What do they maybe don't like about what we're doing now? And kind of just getting that input, and it's been really good so far to kind of just get general ideas. So if you go to the department site LCAD meeting input, the first one there, basically every time we go to a school, Mandy types up the notes from what the teachers have said, and we post it on this page. So each time we go to a school, we add it. So we've been to Bishop's Peak, we've been to Baywood, we've been to Del Mar so far. So just each week as we go to a couple of school sites, that gets added onto that page. So Kim, if you go back. Now, what we know is that not everyone is going to be willing to talk about things when you're in a general meeting like that and maybe cutting a program or cutting a position and the person's in the audience. So we're following this up with a survey monkey, an anonymous survey monkey, to, again, what do they think about the district's priorities? What do they think about where we're headed? Do they understand the budget presentation? And really also giving them an opportunity to give us even more input through that anonymous process. I'm going to gather all that from each of the sites and post that as well on this website. So again, this is all just initial information gathering, talking to staff before we even develop our LCAP. Because once we develop it, once we get that together, then we're going to be meeting with union groups and the DLAC and the board and going through a whole, you know, kind of a bigger process. But I will say, and Rick and Kristen can attest to it, it's a positive thing. It's a positive thing for us to get out and talk to teachers, to hear their concerns, to hear their thoughts and ideas, and hopefully we'll be able to take those as we develop the LCAP and decide where we need to head. So that's what's happening right now. And again, a lot of that information, the slideshow, the PowerPoint that we do, the kind of information about the LCAP process that we give out, all of that is available right on our website. Okay?
Mr. Buckman, you have your...
Yeah, just... Ryan, you said are there more meetings still coming?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Kim, are those?
There's a calendar.
On that, yeah, they're right. There's the calendars on there.
Yeah, we've got a dozen of them more to come.
Okay. I do remember the calendar. Okay. Thanks.
We've invited school site councils to attend if they can. You know, so Dr. Prater's going to have kind of more meetings to tie into, but we've tried to get as many people there as possible.
And is the timing usually the same? It's 3 in the afternoon, 4?
It varies. Some are staff meetings,
right,
and some are the TCT time where we go beforehand. So it does depend.
Okay.
And we can probably put that up.
Consultation calendar, I believe. So, okay, if you go to March.
Sorry. If you go to March, you'll see the different colors. March 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 13th, 14th, 20th, 18th. Now, I think I captured those. Those are going to be luncheons with key groups that I've invited. And I'd love for you, if you'd like, to join. So I'll make sure you get an invitation as well. And that's what we will do when we meet.
And I, if at all possible, I would like to attend at least one site.
Sure.
If it's not going to change the dynamics.
Yeah. Marilyn?
I guess
maybe what Mr. Buckman just said answered my question, but I'm thinking if we have these luncheons that there'll be various representative groups there, are the site meetings where we want staff to feel that they're able to be forthcoming about their issues and concerns, would it be appropriate to have board members there, or do you think that might be inhibiting?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think it would. I don't think the staff would matter. I think they would be okay with it, to be honest with you. I don't think it's a problem.
Okay, thank you.
And again, if they don't want to share things at that meeting, because we give them a lot of information, they do have the opportunity right after. They can email us, let us know, and then the Survey Monkey really elicits even more input.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions or comments? Okay. I think we're ready to move on to the approval of the Common Core funding plan. And I wanted to say that before you got too far.
Thank you very much. So we brought the Common Core funding plan to the board last meeting. You know, I guess from mobility, What are kids going to need? How are they going to use it? You know, differentiation for students. So a lot of those ideas were discussed, and it's definitely an exciting time, I think, as we move forward.
Mr. Buckman, do you have a question?
Yeah, just really quickly. I know there's been some discussion about laptops versus the big box desktop stuff. And when I looked at the LCAP, some of the wants in LCAP, and when I looked at the wants in the Common Core, I'm seeing a lot of, because I want to see it, I guess, a lot of people requesting laptops. And I don't know how that's going to balance out. Hi, Kim.
So as I'm meeting with each site, we're going over the options. And you're right, mobility is one definite piece of that. So what we're looking at is we go through each vision, and we go through each XP that needs to be replaced, and we say, let's talk about not just replacing it one-to-one, but how can we look forward and meet the school's vision, and definitely mobility is a piece of that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions, or
yeah,
Mr. Pinkert?
Tonight would be our opportunity to hopefully have the board approve this plan. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. So if there are any questions, or if someone would like to move approval, we could do that. Yeah,
I'll move approval of the Common Core funding plan.
Thank you, Mrs. Roger.
And I'll second.
So the motion is made by Mrs. Roger and seconded by Dr. Eisendreich Rogers. Is there any further discussion? Does this, Mrs. Holmes, does this require a roll call vote?
No.
Okay. So all in favor of the motion to approval the spending plan for the Common Core, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And please note that Mr. Unger is absent. Thank you. Okay, so now we are into item 9.03, and that's the special education class reorganization. And Mrs. Frost, thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'll keep it brief. I do want you to know that I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this reorganization. For the past several years, C.L. Smith has been a sort of hub for special education classes in our district. While all of our sites have resource programs for our students, only 5 of our elementary schools have what we call special day classes for students, for those students with a little bit more intense academic or behavioral needs, none of which have as many as we have at C.L. Smith Elementary School. While we have an opportunity right now in the reorganization of Bishop's Peak and Teach to move a couple of classes over to Bishop's Peak, and that's what we've been working on the last several months in Student Support Services. After much thought and consultation, we are going to be moving 2 of our less intensive classes from C.L. Smith to Bishop's Peak campus. This decision doesn't come lightly. It's only after much consultation with our current teachers. We have a special education leadership committee and even the site principals who have weighed in on this decision. And a number of things are in place to make sure that this is a smooth transition. First of all, our teachers will be moving with the program. Melissa Quinn and Greg Kramer are very talented teachers of our less intensive population, and they will be moving over to Bishop's Peak. We will provide a field trip and other opportunities for the current students who will be moving to Bishop's to kind of smooth their transition. Dan Block, the principal of Bishop's Peak, has already worked with his staff. They know that these classes are coming over, and they're very excited about the opportunity. Affected families have been informed as well. We sent out a letter to the families to make sure that they were at least aware that this was happening next year and to give them an opportunity to weigh in if they would like. It's also important to know that all of the services that our students currently receive at C.L. Smith will be available at Bishop's Peak. The move does have a little bit of expense involved. As I said, we will provide a field trip for our students. We'll definitely provide training for the teachers at Bishop's Peak so that they can really welcome these students on their campus, welcome them into their classrooms as well. And then finally, we might have to do some minor alterations to a classroom at Bishop's Peak to make it even more appropriate for these classes that we'll be moving over. Finally, I want to share with you that this move is really indicative of the philosophy of student support services and best practices in our field. I think you guys are very aware of my background. I've been 10 years in this district. I've been the principal of two middle schools here. I've been a principal of a middle school up in the Bay Area.
And will transportation be an issue for the families?
They will be offered exactly the same transportation that they're currently offered, and I've even worked with transportation already to let them know about the changes that we're going to be making.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I remember with our kids at C.L. Smith and the inclusion of kids in the classrooms, and I think this is an important step. And I think things have gotten kind of a little lopsided, and I think this is a beneficial reorganization. Thank
Very
you.
Good. Thank you.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Mrs. Frost, for years the board was kind of sold the concept that hubs or concentrations of special education classes was the model by which students were best served. And I think that there was a hub at Smith and also a hub at Baywood on the coast.
Right.
So it makes sense to me, just as a person and a parent, that dispersing these classes creates healthy school environments. Can you explain to me the reason for the hub concept and why you're moving from it?
I think that there is research to support hubs as there is research to support the move that we're making right now. You still will find some districts that have schools that are entirely supporting only special education students. In this case, in our district, I just think that we better serve our students by giving them opportunities on other campuses. And I mentioned earlier, I don't think it's just our special education children that benefit from a move like this. I think our regular education children benefit as well in this district. And I have to say that in terms of hubs, C.L. Smith did a beautiful job of it. They really did. Those general education teachers welcomed the kids into their classroom when they were mainstreaming. And I absolutely believe that that will happen at Bishop's Peak and at any other elementary school. So I'm not sure that I really answered your question. I think an argument can be made for hubs, and there was a time when that was appropriate in this district. But right now, with the opportunities that we have to move some of these classes, to have other students find value, to balance out the special education in our district, I think it makes a little bit more sense.
I totally agree with you. I think when, you know, I was asking questions, one of the things that was that I was told was that it provided easier access for staff of various types, psychologists and nurses and whoever else, you know, might be required to not have to move among so many schools, but rather to be able to be concentrated. But you don't see any problem with
that. Will be something that I have to change. It will be the case that I will have to have more psychologist time at Bishop's Peak next year. I will have a program specialist spend more time at Bishop's Peak. So it will draw some of the support away from C.L. Smith and towards Bishop's Peak. But I think that in the grand scheme of things, I think that is okay in our efforts to support these students.
The support will follow the students, is what you're saying.
The support will follow the students,
okay.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If I can just add one quick comment, Mrs. Roger, too. One of the reasons you kind of designed the hub, I think what we what we did both at Smith and Bishop's Smith and Baywood was so that there was a continuity of service for special education students that might be transitioning between programs. Because occasionally you will see a student in a SDC program be able to transition into a more mainstreamed environment. And so I think what Mrs. Frost is doing, what we're planning on doing, will still allow for that. There is a full resource specialist at Bishop's Peak, and this is the less intensive program that's going over there. So there's that opportunity for transition. It's just that concentration level. We saw it at Baywood, and we're certainly seeing it at C.L. Smith. Starts having kind of the opposite effect we'd want it to have on a campus. And so I, too, loved having SDC classes when I was a principal of a site. It just makes the whole school environment that much healthier for everybody. So yeah. I think this is good for everybody.
I think it makes good sense. Thank you.
Are there any more questions or comments? So at this point, you're interested in perhaps approval of this. It is. It's listed as a possible item for.
Is it just?
No, it's not. I'm sorry.
We're just
our students of the 21st century, kids carrying cell phones when we're talking about peer development, things like that. So we formed an IMAP committee that was made up of 5th and 6th grade teachers in our district, parents, a few principals, Judith Geyer, Darla Batistic, who is our health and family living trainer, and a local physician. We reviewed our old videos and then reviewed possible new videos. We actually met three different times because we weren't quite satisfied with one and picked another. And then at the same time, we held two sessions, at one at the coast and one in town, for parents to come and view the videos and receive feedback from them. From there, we made a final recommendation, and I bring that to you tonight with the goal of updating our current videos. This in no way is a change of our health and family curriculum. It's an update of the videos only.
Is there anybody from the public who would like to comment on this? Seeing none, we'll close that. Mrs. Rogers, did you have your lights on? Is that it's a permanent?
She can't turn it on.
My microphone is broken.
Okay, all right. Mr. Millar.
I just so these items that are listed are videos.
Correct.
They're updated videos.
Correct.
It's a fascinating titles for them. I'm just surprised. The video, pardon me, VHS tapes. All right, I know I'm a little dated. I'll never forget the family health video I saw in 1962 in high school. Still haunts me to this day. But I think we are due for updating that. But thank you.
I think the hair alone in the 1980s videos has to make it something we have to change.
Someone suggested I show a couple of the older videos to you here tonight just for comparison, but I think we're probably getting late here, so we'll refrain from that.
Another time, perhaps. Okay. Another time. Is there any further questions or comments? Okay. Thank you very much, Mrs. Shields. Okay, so we're at item 9.05. Oh, this one we need to adopt. I'm sorry. Okay. It's the first reading. It's optional. We could adopt it if we so desire. Okay. So is that a motion from?
Oh.
I'll move approval of the adoption of the listed items.
Mr. Millar makes a motion for approval. And a second?
And I'll second.
Second for Mrs. Roger. Any further discussion? Okay. Then all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Any nays? Any abstentions? And Mr. Unger is absent. So motion carries 6-0 with one absent. All right. Now we can go to item 9.05, which is the new and modified secondary courses for 2014 and 2015.
Great. Tonight I have before you new and modified courses. I would like to make note that at the next board meeting you will have a presentation from Los Osos Middle School about their STEAM electives. Otherwise, I would ask that you would approve these new and modified courses.
Any questions or comments on the new and modified courses? You'll make a motion. Mr. Buck?
Yeah, I read them, and if nobody has any comments, then I'll move approval of the... What item are we on here?
9.05, new and modified secondary courses.
9.05, as presented.
Okay, and a second by Mr. Buckman.
Very good.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And I see no opposition, and Mr. Unger is absent, so the motion carries 6-0. All right, we are now at item 9.06, and this is rescheduling the board workshop from January 21st to either February 14th or February 11th. I have February 14th on my mind, or the February 25th.
Presented by us.
Mrs. Rogers and Mr. Buckman and I are your subcommittee.
That's correct.
And we have exchanged emails on the subject, and we think that we've arrived at the 25th as the date that's best for everybody and gives us the most time to set up our agenda. And we've cleared the times on that date with everyone, and it seems that everyone is able to make it from 4 to 7 p.m. So if that's all right with everybody, we'll go ahead with our planning then of that evening. Location to be determined at this point, but it'll be somewhere in the near vicinity of where we are tonight. But not
we're already presented and structure the agenda around those items. Is everybody comfortable with having until Friday to come up with any additional ideas or concerns?
Just to clarify, that's this Friday.
That's right. We're in this week, Jim, and that would be this Friday.
Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, could you provide us with an updated list of topics that that the committee already has, so that we can just add to rather than...
I will resend tomorrow.
Okay. I already have it, but I didn't...
You do.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for anticipating my request.
It must be afternoon.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, did you have another...
Oh, no, I do not. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So... we're clear on that. That's on the 25th, and this Friday is our last day to make any
drop-dead date.
Any comments or requests for corrections. Okay, so we are now on item 9.07, which is the Tri-County Education Coalition, and there is a little note there on here about this being, we've been a member of this for some time, and our annual dues are about $100, and the tri-counties are San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura counties, and it includes some auxiliary organizations and agencies, and we are looking for a representative, I believe, or at least that's the request. No, we're not looking for a representative. I have anybody, board members who would... Yes.
Why are we in the Tri-County Coalition? What do they do for us?
Mr. Buckman, do you wish to answer that?
Sure. The Tri-County Education Coalition was formed about 25 years ago. It's the model of the state education coalition. It was the first in the state. What it does is it brings to the table SEIU, CSEA, CTA, AFT, businesses, PTA, and they all work together to find common ground to bring to Sacramento and to bring to the legislatures and to the local bodies that can represent public education. Plus, four times a year they meet. This Friday, Jack O'Connell will be presenting on LCFF and Common Core and SBAC, and LCAP and SBAC. So in the past, Dr. Ballantyne has represented the district, Chris Unger has represented the district, and I have been a part of it on and off for the last 25 years. So I'm asking to represent the district. It is usually held in Goleta, and there's usually a trip to Sacramento where we actually meet with the legislators, with this common, and meet with the governor's staff, with this common message about public education. I'm offering it at this time to just cover my own costs to make this happen. And what it brings back to us is the most recent information that's going on, and it does give us a voice both locally, county, and statewide, a common voice.
Thank you for that. It strikes me as it is for many of those things is redundant to CSBA and the other organizations that we're in. And, you know, this may not come as a surprise to people who worked with me, that I really question the value of these group trips to Sacramento to, you know, to talk to the legislatures. I've seen very little. It just doesn't seem to really accomplish a whole lot. But anyway, that's just my view of it.
Mrs. Roger, are you? No, I understand. It's okay. All right. Okay. Mr. Buckman, did you wish to say something further?
No, I'd just like to appreciate. I would appreciate representing the organization and promise to bring back a report after each meeting.
And it notes down here on our agenda item, this is an agenda item and it provides an opportunity for the board to consider its level of involvement with this organization. We are currently paying them $100 a year to be a member. Is that correct?
That's true. To my knowledge, we've belonged since the inception of the group in 1988. This district has never formally named a representative during your December meeting when people take subcommittee assignments right. or representations. But I will share that when I was a board member for Templeton, the board member fit in and felt that it got us much of anywhere for San Luis Coastal. It is an open meeting. We receive notifications about their meetings, and attendance is open to all of the board members to go at a time of interest. So the membership that we have, it's a quasi-lobbying group, but there isn't a requirement in membership that we name a representative to attend. So it's just here for your discussion to kind of figure out how involved your board wants to be with this group.
And just for my part, I can confirm that some years ago, and it's now about 12, that I had a discussion, I believe 11 or 12 years ago, with Mr. Unger about my participation in this group, because I was the local SLCTA president at the time. I think that might be a difference with CSBA, because it actually has the involvement of the various labor groups. So that's just an observation on my part.
And if I can, I'm not sure I served with Kim on the group, but over the years there's been a tremendous amount of discussion among the labor groups, management, superintendents, and school board members, where there has been a gelling. And I can remember sometimes some very heated discussion when CSEA did not want us to support a specific piece of legislation and management was in favor of it. And we were able to come to consensus, come to message points. And it is not that well known here, but it's really well respected up in Sacramento. And so when three counties go up with a joint voice, it's been phenomenal. We have sat in the governor's meeting room, which is just off his office, with some of his top aides, and I think they've listened, and I think we've made a difference. And part of it's because of the scope of the organization and the number of groups that it represents.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Well, I would say since we pay our $100 dues a year, and given that Mr. Buckman is willing to
take on this responsibility and willing to pay his way to Sacramento and support himself while he's there. And given that I'm the CSEA representative, and I would be delighted to have Mr. Buckman represent us in that way, I would be happy to support Mr. Buckman's interest in traveling to Sacramento to report back to us about how our three counties are working together and what information they're garnering there.
Well, I would agree with that also. I don't think this requires any particular action on the board's part other than like we've done in the past, you said in December, and the various assignments to various groups. So if there's a consensus on the board, I believe we can just agree that Mr. Buckman will represent us. No? So, Mr. Millar? Okay.
I don't see the need. I also have some concerns about us maintaining the integrity of our decisions and inputs, us, the school district. I mean, it's nice to have all those folks get together and talk and everything, but I prefer that the voice that we want heard comes from this board. So, but anyway, my main problem with it is that I don't understand where it fills in for all the other numerous organizations that we're already in that provide the same kinds of lobbying and issue identifying and things like that. So.
If I can just one more time.
Sure.
And then drop it. The unique part of this, just the way that it's unique up in Sacramento, that there's this Ed Coalition that brings these same groups to the table to come up with common messages. This group is not CSBA, it's not CSEA, SEIU. It's a group of everyone, including some public folks, that then comes up with a common voice on topics that are that they can speak to as one voice for public education. And so in that way, it's extremely different. And then just to clarify, there are four meetings, I believe four meetings a year, when we have some really high-powered speakers come down.
Mr. Buckman would be representing our board and our views, and I'm not always in agreement with Mr. Buckman, as I'm not always in agreement with anyone on the board or whatever. So, but if he has interest in doing it, and it's not a great expense to us, then I'm fine with saying, go ahead and do it.
All right, so let's just move with that then. Okay, very good. All right, so we're going to move on from here. We are now at item 9.08, which is the approval to pay board member salary for permissible absence.
And I would move that we approve to pay board member Chris Unger for permissible absence.
So the motion by to approve of the permissible absence and the salary by Mrs. Schaefer, and a second by Dr. Eisenrath Rogers. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
It's growing late. Okay, we have disposed of those items, and we are now on the action consent calendar. And the action consent items. At this time, is there anybody who wishes to pull any of the items?
That's a good way to do it. No.
Okay.
We used to read them all.
Well, I can read them all.
Nobody pulled any. So
Everybody's looking at me like, let's get this going here,
if
folks. Thank you.
If you will you acknowledge me, Mr. Questenberry?
Yes, Mrs. Rogers. Mrs. Rogers.
So now you want to be acknowledged.
I move approval of items 10.1 through 10.6.
I'll second.
So we have a motion to approve items 10.1 through 10.6. by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mr. Millar. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed? And Mr. Unger is absent, so the motion carries 6-0 with one absence. And now we are at item 11.01, which is action on consent agenda items.
We just did that.
I'm sorry. I meant
advanced agenda.
Advanced agenda. That's what I meant.
All right.
Anything for the advanced agenda? Okay. Seeing none, any board reports? Mr. Buckman and Mr. Buckman.
I did have the opportunity to attend the C.L. Smith math night. I couldn't stay the whole time, which was probably good because I know they got into higher math. But while I was there, the question that was asked to the parents was add 26 and 24. And then it went, how did you do it? And, you know, I did it, 26 plus 24, carry the 4, carry the 2. There were two other ways. I can't remember the third way. One of the women there said, well, what I did is I took one from the 26, made them both 25, and that's how I got to 50. And it's like, I'm sorry, I never would have thought of that, and it just goes to the 20 ways of the kids are coming up with solutions. So I was just amazed. And then I have somehow received a book called The Third Teacher, which goes to, I've started to read it, and as we go into our facilities master plan, it's very interesting because it talks about the design of rooms and how much light and all how all of that affects student learning. And if we're going to be looking at our master plan, I'm finding it a very interesting book.
So, thank you, Mr. Buckman. I just have a brief report. I went to the Los Osos Middle School History Day. I was one of the judges, and I'm pleased to inform you that those students are exceptionally bright. And the project from Mr. Wilcox's class, I got to judge websites, and it was both challenging for me to navigate the websites, but that's just because of my lack of computer skills. But I did learn quite a bit, and so it was fun, and I hope they invite me back. Anything else? Any other? Yes, Mr. Millar.
I had the pleasure to be in Atlanta, Georgia during the ice storm, and I want to commend our transportation department for never having left school children overnight on school buses in freezing weather. And so it was a bad situation. Kids sleeping in schools, staff, the school district staff showing up and staying with the kids. It was a very crazy time, but it makes